Thanks for coming, everybody. Welcome to our Lou Jones breakfast. And I was telling the speakers that it took me an hour and 5 minutes to get in here today from New Berlin, so therefore there will be no more Lou Jones breakfasts. They will be lunches or dinners so that I don't get freaked out on the home bridge as I'm trying to drive in the fast way. We're so pleased that they're back again this year, Tom Schreiner and Pete Blaine, to talk to us about the Supreme Court. And as far as December's meeting, we don't have anything lined up. We usually have an ethics presentation, but that doesn't seem to be in the cards. So just keep an eye out on the biker listserv and on the website, and we will keep you posted if we are able to put together an ethics program or some other program for December. Thanks again to Tom and Pete.
Morning. We're going to talk about a couple of cases that the Supreme Court decided during last term, more or less related to bankruptcy. A couple of them related to bankruptcy and the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and their interconnection. And then, because there were only three, right?
Right.
Because there were only three actually decided last year, we're going to talk about a couple of them on which cert has been granted that are to be decided by the Supreme Court this year or not. Doubt has been raised about one of them that's already been argued. And the court has already dismissed as improvidently granted certiorari that it granted in another case. And we may engage in some speculation about the attitude of the Supreme Court toward bankruptcy cases, which you all may have a view on as well. At any rate, let me start with the Jevic case, J-E-V-I-C, because I don't like to say Krzyzewski, the name of the petitioner, versus Jevic Holding Corp. This was a case decided last term, earlier this year, and the issue is whether a Chapter 11 case may be terminated by a structured dismissal, so-called, that distributes estate property in violation of the Bankruptcy Code's priority scheme. And how this unfolded is kind of interesting. Jevic was a trucking company in, I want to say, New Jersey. Yeah, headquartered in New Jersey. That was going through hard times and got acquired by a venture capital firm, Sun Capital, set up a subsidiary wisely to actually purchase the company, and it was financed by CIT Group, the purchase. After acquisition, things didn't get much better. Of course, buying something in 2006 was not a good investment decision for a business, because by 2008 it was headed for the tank. It did not give WARN Act notices under either federal or state law to its employees until the day before it filed. That's a violation of the law. Sometimes you can't do anything about it, but it gives rise to claims. So they filed in May of 2008. The truck drivers who worked for it filed a class action lawsuit against both the debtor, Jevic, and Sun, the parent of the subsidiary that had acquired the company, alleging the violation of the applicable state and federal WARN Act, you know, Work Adjustment and Restraining Notification Act, which basically says you got to give, 90 days or something like that notice that you're going to put people out of work so they can get their lives in order. Of course, you know, nobody knows 90 days before they're going in that they're going in. I say nobody does, but it doesn't happen very often. And when you're going down, you got other priorities, I guess. So anyway, they brought a class action, and they prevailed on their claims against the debtor, no surprise, pretty plain violation, but not against the against Sun Capital, the parent company, the entity that had acquired the debtor. But in the meantime, in the bankruptcy case itself, and this is fairly common too, right, the committee brought a fraudulent conveyance action against CIT, the financer, and Sun, the borrower, and the parent of the lender, or the parent of the acquirer, And again, this is common, right? It's sort of a, you buy the company, you give liens to the bank, and, you know, this often leads, if bankruptcy ensues pretty quickly, to fraudulent conveyance action by the creditors committee. You know, what else is there to go after? Somebody with some money, right? A deep pocket. So the committee's litigation proceeded for over 3 years. So now in March of 2012, which is almost 4 years after the filing, representatives of all the major players, including the truck drivers, met to try to negotiate a settlement to divvy up what was left, which wasn't a hell of a lot. There was $1.7 million in cash, all of which was subject to Sun's lien. So in a way, you can think of it as Sun's money. And the lawsuits against CIT and Sun, that is, the fraudulent transfer cases. So here's who got the settlement, not the truck drivers. This is the key to the whole thing. The truck drivers didn't take part in the settlement. The committee, with the transfer claims, obviously representing the unsecured creditors, Jevic, the debtor, CIT and Sun, that is the parent of the purchaser and the lender, reached a settlement, and that resulted in the suits being dismissed. And the $1.7 million in cash and an additional $2 million paid by CIT were deposited into an account to pay administrative claims and tax claims. Okay, what are we talking about here? Priority claims, right? And then unsecured claims on a pro rata basis. Who we skipped? We've skipped the truck drivers. They're not in the structured dismissal. The case was to be dismissed, and the amounts paid in accordance with the settlement to the participating creditors, with nothing paid to the truck drivers. Doesn't sound right, does it? Well, it didn't sound right to the truck drivers. The truck drivers were asserting a claim of $12.8 million, over $8 million of which was priority wage claims, entitled to priority. They objected to the proposed settlement. The bankruptcy court, and I think this was the Delaware bankruptcy court, at any rate it's in the Third Circuit, is where it came up, so it's either New Jersey or Delaware. The bankruptcy court noted that structured dismissals had been approved in other courts. Well, that's true. The bankruptcy court also found, this is not questioned either, that there were insufficient assets to pursue the fraudulent transfer claims. You know, somebody's got to pay the lawyers. No possibility of a confirmable plan. Sounds pretty easy to conclude that. And that under any disposition, most of the creditors would receive nothing outside of the settlement. And the court determined this warranted approving the settlement. The bankruptcy concluded that while plans of reorganization must follow the absolute priority rule, we all know that, right? You don't skip people on the way down to the bottom. You pay everybody going down unless they consent to a different treatment. Plans of reorganization must follow the priority rule. Court said settlements don't need to. So the truck drivers appealed, and they requested a stay of the approval order, and the bankruptcy court denied it. The truck drivers did not take their stay request to the district court while the appeal to the district court was pending, so the settlement was implemented. 1,000 checks went out to priority tax and unsecured priority tax claims, unsecured claim holders. The district court eventually affirmed the order approving the settlement, and the truck drivers appealed to the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit took the approach that structured dismissals were authorized by the code, but acknowledged that there was a split in the circuits regarding whether an order authorizing a structured dismissal could sanction distributions that violated the code's priority scheme. And admitting that it was a close call, the Third Circuit held that strict compliance with the code's priority scheme was not required where there were, quote, specific, justifiable, and credible grounds warning a deviation. So it affirmed the district court. I ask myself, and you'll ask yourself if you look at Justice Breyer's opinion for the court on this, where is this structured dismissal in the code? You know, He starts out by saying, well, there are three things you can do with a case. In Chapter 11, you can confirm a plan, or you can dismiss the case, or you can have a structured dismissal, for which he quotes, I think, an ABI study as the statutory source. Here's the source, the statutory source of a structured dismissal. Section 349B of the code. Unless the court, that is the bankruptcy court, for cause, okay, whatever that is, orders otherwise, this is the whole basis for a structured dismissal. A dismissal of the case reinstates any proceeding superseded under Section 543, any, you know, pre-existing receivership or something, any transfer avoided under various sections during the pendency of the case in Chapter 11 or preserved, any lien avoided under 506D. It also vacates any order, judgment, or transfer ordered under other sections of the code and revests the property of the estate in the entity in which such property was vested immediately before the commencement of the case under this title. That's all we got. That's the statutory basis for this whole structured dismissal business. Justice Breyer, this really is a unanimous opinion. It's 6-2 because Justice Thomas and Justice Alito dissent on the ground that they would have thrown the case out of the Supreme Court as improvidently granted, something we'll get to and again, and when we talk about a case this year, because they just weren't satisfied that it was properly developed and that the issue that the court, well, actually, they weren't satisfied that the court was deciding the issue on which it had granted certiorari, and I think they're probably right. But let's just take what Justice Breyer said for the court. He starts out, as I say, saying there are three possible outcomes, a confirmed plan, a conversion to 7, or a dismissal under 1112B. Then he said the objective of dismissal is to return to the pre-petition financial status quo. That's pretty easily derivable from 349B. Where that is not possible, he points out, 349B permits the bankruptcy court for cause to alter the dismissal's ordinary restorative consequences by approving a structured dismissal. He just says it as if that's a phrase in the code. As I say, he quotes, I think, an ABI study. Points out that in a Chapter 7 case, distribution of the estate's assets must follow the prescribed priority scheme, and that while you can deviate from the priority scheme in a Chapter 11 plan, you may only do so. You may not do so over the objection of a class if it proposes priority violating distributions. However, with respect to a Chapter 11 case, the code doesn't provide what priority rules, if any, apply to the distribution of the estate's assets. After exploring the facts of the case, court started out by looking at the standing of the petitioners, and this is an interesting twist. Everybody argues standing nowadays, right? Every time you can. The respondents argued, that is, those who had gone through the settlement, Sun and CIT, that any without violating the ordinary priority rules, there would have been no settlement. Without the settlement, the fraudulent conveyance lawsuit had no value. Thus, the respondents argued that the petitioners who received nothing in the dismissal suffered no damages, because without the settlement, they wouldn't have received anything anyway. The court pointed out, correctly, I think, that Sun, that is the owner of the business, had already won the Warren suit, and that the demand that the truck drivers be excluded from the distributions under the dismissal was for the purpose of depriving them of funds to pursue an appeal in their, was depriving them of funds to pursue that action against Sun. If Sun's reasons for demanding the petitioners receive no distribution disappeared, which is they were complaining, don't give the money to them, they'll just use it to sue us, and if you do that, we won't be part of the settlement. We won't kick in $2 million, we won't kick in the cash in the business. If that disappeared, why should some of the proceeds of the settlement not go to the truck drivers? Moreover, CIT and Son had settled the lawsuit by the creditors committee for $3.7 million, which made little sense if there was truly no chance of success, so the court says. Whether that's realistic or not, I guess we just don't get to question. So even if there was a chance that the suit might prove fruitless, the petitioner's loss of the right to bring the suit on their own was sufficient to cause the court to conclude that the petitioners had standing. So then the court turns to this principal question: can a bankruptcy court approve a structured dismissal that provides for distributions that don't follow the ordinary priority rules without the affected creditor's consent? The answer is simple: no, may not do that. The priority system of distributions to creditors, he points out, is fundamental to the code's operation, and if the court had intended structured dismissals to be a backdoor means to achieve the kind of non-consensual priority violating final distributions that the code otherwise prohibits, it would have said so. Quoting something the court says often, Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. Why wouldn't it have been in there, 349B, if that was what was intended? The Chapter 11 dismissal provisions seek a restoration of pre-petition financial status where that isn't possible for cause. And this is really what the court says the bankruptcy court can use. That's what 349B means when it says for cause. Can protect the rights acquired in reliance on the pendency of the bankruptcy case to the extent that it's able to do so, but nothing allows it to approve end-of-case distributions that would be impermissible under either a 7 or an 11. Court expressed no view about the validity of structured dismissals in general, didn't have to, said that non-priority distributions before the end of the case or to preserve the debtor as a going concern were not prohibited. For example, pointing to first-day order, wage orders, critical vendor orders, financing roll-ups, and interim distributions of settlement proceeds to fund continuing litigation, and took on the Third Circuit's question about the rarity, the rare circumstances in which a court could find sufficient reasons, and they said no, the rare case exception would soon gobble up the rule, and we're not going to approve it. The dissent, as I say, Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Alito, said, well, that isn't the question we granted cert on, which was whether a bankruptcy court can authorize a distribution of settlement proceeds in a manner that violates a statutory priority scheme. Instead, they decided this narrower question, and he said, well, there isn't enough case law below in the circuit courts on this novel question. We shouldn't be dealing with this. It hasn't briefed. We're making this up, so I would have dismissed it as improvidently granted. Neither he nor Alito said they disagreed with the result, and it's hard for me to believe they really did. They just didn't think this was a case on which it should have taken up. Interestingly, despite the court's, and this is mentioned in the footnote on third or fourth page of the outline, despite the courts having said there's nothing wrong with first-day orders, some of the first-day orders, critical vendor orders, a couple of bankruptcy courts around the country have, since this case came down and citing it, declined to approve a critical vendor motion or a proposed distribution outside of settlement proceeds, which the court saw as a prelude to a structured dismissal. So,
all right, we're going to turn to Midland Funding versus Johnson, and that's going to be followed by Henson. And while Henson isn't actually a bankruptcy case, it relates to Midland because both deal with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which I'm going to call the FDCPA because I can't say all those words together. Midland was decided in May. Henson was decided in June. And when you hear Tom talk about Henson, you may come to the conclusion that I did, that had that order been reversed, they never would have decided Midland. Midland had to do with the issue of whether a debt collector filing a proof of claim in a Chapter 13 on a clearly time-barred claim violated the FDCPA, and whether the bankruptcy code precluded a lawsuit under the FDCPA for that action.
That's a what, false or fraudulent or?
Right. No. False, deceptive, or misleading, right, or unfair and unconscionable acts to collect a debt by a debt collector, which is a key term. In this case, not a lot at stake, $1,870. Midland bought the debt filed the proof of claim, which was clearly time-barred. They noted on the proof of claim that it was time-barred. The Chapter 13 trustee objected to it, and the claim was disallowed. 2 days later, Johnson, the debtor, filed an action in district court claiming that the FDCPA was violated by Midland because they filed this time-barred proof of claim. The district court said, gee, a claim is a right to payment. A statute of limitations is a defense. There's no bar here, and ruled for Midland. Johnson appealed to the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit said, yeah, there's no bar to filing the claim, but the sanctions that might flow from that still survive, and they reversed and ruled for Johnson. Midland appealed to the Supreme Court, and Justice Breyer, as he did in Jevic, wrote the opinion. He started out by talking about the right to payment. He said a claim is a right to payment, and although Johnson said that the words really should be enforceable claim, they're not in the statute. It is a claim. So the enforceable claim concept doesn't appear. He turned to the two sections of the FDCPA, seriously misleading or unfair and unconscionable. And with respect to seriously misleading, he said, the statute is aimed at a Chapter 13 trustee, a bankruptcy professional who's schooled in the statute and in the rules. So we don't find that the statute or the action of filing a time-barred claim is seriously misleading. However, the unfair and unconscionable aspect gives us a little bit more trouble. And he notes that a number of lower courts have ruled that where a debt collector files an action on a time-barred claim in a civil action, not bankruptcy, they've been sanctioned.
He tried to sneak one past the debtor.
Tried to sneak one past the debtor, and often do. And
right.
Debt collectors call up, attempt to prevail on the debtor to make another payment, which, if it's done, will restart the statute of limitations and take advantage of debtors who aren't sophisticated or, as the court said, might be embarrassed. And they've now transferred that action to bankruptcy court. The court said the unfairness isn't necessarily present in a Chapter 13. The debtor commences the action. So the debtor is taking a conscious decision to prevail or to take advantage of the bankruptcy system. And there's a Chapter 13 trustee who's a professional who understands the way the rules work and is there to make sure that untimeliness is objected to. He goes on to say untimeliness is an affirmative defense. It doesn't jeopardize the nature of the claim. And then goes on to say disallowance, once that occurs, assuming the system works, Chapter 13 trustee finds the claim, finds that it's outside the statute, objects to it, and successfully has it disallowed, benefits the debtor because the debtor is therefore discharged at the conclusion of its plan payments and doesn't have to worry about that, can get mortgages, can get other loans. Goes on to say if untimeliness is a reason to allow the FDCPA to be invoked, what other reasons are there? And kind of reopen the door and let a lot of other things in that we can't contemplate. Says the bankruptcy code is carefully balanced. The rights and protections of the debtor and the obligations of the debtor are carefully drawn up by Congress, and to impose the FDCPA would upset that balance. Substantively, to allow an action by the debtor creates a right of action that doesn't appear to exist anywhere. Procedurally, what would result from allowing an action under the FDCPA is it would kick all these cases to civil court and require the civil courts to determine the state of mind of the claim filer and to determine in subsequent actions whether the statute applies. The court relied heavily on the Advisory Committee for the Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure, which rejected the requirement that claim filers specifically affirmatively say that the claim is within the statute of limitations. The committee rejected that, and the court said, you know, that makes sense to us. And then they went on to talk at the end of the opinion about the split in the various courts and said that's enough to cause us to say that filing an untimely claim is not unfair or unconscionable. Justice Sotomayor wrote a vigorous dissent joined by Justices Ginsburg and Kagan and says flat out, professional debt collectors have a $1 billion industry. They went to civil court. They tried to have their claims, stale claims, allowed in civil court and got slapped down. There's actually the federal government actually sought sanctions against a debt collector in civil court for filing a raft of untimely claims. And what they're trying to do is cause the bankruptcy system to fail. She goes on to say, the dynamics outside of bankruptcy apply inside of bankruptcy. It's not enough to say the debtor takes advantage of the code. The debtor is no more sophisticated in Chapter 13 than they are outside. The debt buyers are simply not in good faith. They're waiting for the system to fail.
She's not really suggesting that it's trying to crash the bankruptcy courts, right?
Well, yeah, she is. She's actually saying that there's so many claims that these debt collectors file that they're clogging the system and causing disruption. Matter of fact, the United States, in its brief supporting Johnson, said they're wasteful and exploitive.
It was a pre-election brief filed by the Solicitor General.
Could have been. Sotomayor then goes on to say, give me a break. Chapter 13 trustees are overworked, they're overburdened, and if the majority thinks they're going to catch all these stale claims, they're sadly mistaken. It just isn't going to happen. It's unrealistic to expect that. Then she goes on to say, as a matter of fact, if they slip through the cracks and the claim is allowed and a payment is made in a plan, it restarts the statute of limitations. And the debtor is likely to be worse off walking out of bankruptcy court than they did when they walked in. And she said the majority's ruling is a trap for the unwary, and it is unconscionable and unfair. And she says, you know, our recourse is to amend the FDCPA, but she's not happy about it. So from that case, we're going to move to Henson, which again is not a bankruptcy case, but note that Midland is an action. Tom's going to talk about Henson, which really is a status.
Midland, Henson is a, raises and decides the question whether a purchaser of debt who attempts to collect for its own account as a purchaser of debt would, is a debt collector under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which I will probably call the FDCPA because I have as much difficulty pronouncing the full name as you. So what happened here is City Financial Auto, you know, a car lender, loaned money to the petitioners seeking to buy cars. Bet they weren't new cars. Petitioners defaulted on the loan, on the loans, and then City Financial sold the loans to Santander, which is a defaulted loan purchaser, which aggressively sought to collect the loans. So a little bit like the last case, you know, there isn't an issue here about filing claims barred by the statute of limitations. And the allegation, though, is the debtors here asserted that the collection practices that Santander used violated the FDCPA. Both the district court, and this isn't in bankruptcy, the district court and the Fourth Circuit both held that Santander didn't attempt to collect a debt owed to another, but instead only sought to collect debts that it purchased and owned, taking the position that its actions were outside the protective ambit of the FDCPA. They're not debt collectors, they said. We're not debt collectors. And the Supreme Court, in a unanimous opinion, agreed. Affirmed the Fourth Circuit. This is Justice Gorsuch's first opinion for the court, And I guess there's a tradition that they allow to take one dog and bark unanimously for the court. It isn't always followed, but typically with a new justice. I began by acknowledging that there was a split in the circuits, with the Fourth Circuit, from which this case came, and the 11th Circuit, holding that parties collecting for their own account debts purchased from another are not covered by the FDCPA, and the Third Circuit and the Seventh Circuit ruling the opposite. The Seventh Circuit did so in a case called McKinney versus Caldaway Properties, interesting case from 2008. I think Judge Rovner wrote the opinion. The bankruptcy judge had held that the defendant was a debt collector, even though it was collecting for its own account, and that it had violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act by what it had done. The case came up to the Seventh Circuit, and Judge Rovner's opinion for the court said, yes, it is a debt collector. It does come within the FDCPA, but it didn't violate the FDCPA, so it reversed the bankruptcy court. Judge Sykes wrote an opinion saying, well, I certainly agree they didn't violate the FDCPA. I'm with the court on that. And therefore, it really isn't necessary to decide whether they're a debt collector. But since you've issued an opinion saying they are a debt collector, I'm going to issue an opinion saying they're not a debt collector. So there was actually a dissent by Judge Sykes, as to which the Supreme Court eventually agreed with her. So in the Santander case, both sides agreed that a third party debt collection action is a debt collector and one which collects its own debts is not. So that basically the argument in the case is how to classify those who purchase debt from a third party and seek to collect it. So it's clear under the statute, you're collecting your own debt, you're not a debt collector. If you're collecting for someone else, you are a debt collector. But what if you have purchased after default debt and try to collect it? Now you own it. Is that what rules, the fact that you own it now? And the Supreme Court rules that that is what counts. Pointing out that the court didn't address two related questions. First, whether a party that collected debts it purchased and which also regularly acts as a third-party collection agent is covered by the FDCPA. So are you an all-purpose debt collector if you do some debt collecting and also collect on your own? And second, whether the statutory definition of debt collector encompasses those engaged in any business, the principal purpose of which is a collection of any debts. Didn't answer that question. But looking at the language of the FDCPA, said that it's clear that Congress intended the act to apply to debts currently owed. That's what the FDCPA is all about. Not to debts owed to another in the past. For the defendant to be a debt collector under the act, it must be attempting to collect a debt owed to another. The petitioners had made an argument that the FDCPA was written, and this obviously would have had some bearing on the earlier case too, was written before the advent of the market for defaulted debt. Not that there hasn't always been a market for defaulted debt, but that a major market for defaulted consumer debt, which the petitioners claim is the most significant change to the debt market since 1977, when the FDCPA was passed, and that if Congress had known this industry would blossom, Congress would have treated defaulted debt purchasers the same as third-party debt collection agents. Wrong argument to make to Justice Gorsuch, or for that matter to the whole court. It's our job to faithfully apply the law Congress has written, but it's never our job to rewrite a constitutionally valid statutory text under the banner of speculation about what Congress might have done had it faced a question that on everyone's account it never faced. So they affirmed, observing that the court had no difficulty for imagining a statute that applies the act to anyone collecting any debts, anyone collecting debts originated by another, or to some other class of people still. However, the proper role of the judiciary is to apply, not amend, Congress's work, even though it sometimes needs amending.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Your courtroom, you can ask anything you want, Judge. Yeah.
So the theory was that the statute of limitations is what bars this claim that credit was filed. So
maybe misstating it, but this is my understanding, that there is some distinction under Wisconsin law that it's not simply a defense, but that there is no claim at all. Do you know about that?
It's in chapter 893, such a statement. It is sort of doctrinally true. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference because you still get to plead it as an affirmative defense or you waive it. So yes, in theory there is a difference. In fact, there isn't. There's some case law on that too.
So you're saying even though it's not
right.
Technically a
right.
Right.
Yeah, there's a statute, and there's a 1943 case, a 1943 or 44 case that says, you know, that the running of the statute of limitations bars the debt and not just the collection, essentially. No longer exists as a debt, but you still have to plead it. You get sued on a debt and you don't plead the statute of limitations, you waive it and you lose.
Supreme Court noted that in the footnote, right?
In this case? I think it did, actually.
Yeah. Like Wyoming and Wisconsin.
Yeah. Maryland casualty or something from 1944. Court wasn't paying a lot of attention during the war. Okay.
All right. FTI Consulting versus Merit Management. This is a case to be decided this term. And the issue is whether an LBO, where two private parties use a bank as a conduit, is exempt from avoidance under Section 546E.
That's important because, as we pointed out in the earlier case, this is what happens after businesses get sold and they go bust. You go back, you look at the transaction by which they were acquired and come up with a fraudulent transfer claim, right?
Yep. In this case, the facts are kind of interesting. There were two companies competing for a Pennsylvania licenses for a racino, which was a combination racetrack and casino. And they were head-to-head fighting for these licenses, and they sat back and said, hey, let's not both compete. One of them, Valley View, agreed to buy the other, Bedford Downs, and then have a single party seeking the license, and that's what happened.
When your client tells you that they've had the conversation, hey, let's not both of us compete, does that sort of get you going?
Gets you a little nervous. Valley View paid $55 million for the stock of Bedford Downs, $15 million of which went to Merit Management, one of the larger shareholders. Valley View got one of the two licenses that it needed, didn't get the second, the business failed, and it went into Chapter 11. And FTI Consulting was appointed the liquidating trustee in the Chapter 11 estate and sued Merit Management as one of the shareholders for a fraudulent transfer under Section 548, 544, and 550. The district court found that the payments made, looking at Section 546E, were settlement payments made in connection with a securities contract. And the fact in the transaction, the money to buy the stock was borrowed from Credit Suisse, who transferred the money to Citizens Bank, a Pennsylvania bank, who acted as escrow agent. Citizens Bank held the money, held the stock, and at closing dispersed both to the respective parties. Because the money ran through Citizens Bank, the district court said that was a payment made by or to a financial institution. Putting those two requirements together, 546E applies. The transaction is exempt. The Seventh Circuit took up the appeal and said, not so fast. You know, we're looking at the statute and the language to us isn't really dispositive, isn't really all that clear. And if you read 546E, it is a very complicated section. It has six different enumerated parties and is somewhat circular as you read it. You have to kind of parse through it a number of times. And the court said, well, let's take this example. If I send a postcard through the mail, am I sending it or is the Postal Service sending it? Or if I make an electronic transfer of funds, am I making that transfer or is the bank making a transfer? That's really analogous to what we have here. And the court said that for the benefit of language, which was inserted in 2006, doesn't really help much either. The court said the real issue is whether the statute is intended to include intermediaries. So you've got Valley View on one side, Merit on the other. The money gets there, but going through intermediaries, the court said, does the statute really cover those intermediaries, or is it one unitary transaction through a conduit? The court said it makes sense to understand the safe harbor in connection with the avoidance action. What FTI is trying to avoid here is the transfer from Valley View to Merit. It's not trying to avoid the transfer from Valley View to Credit Suisse, to Citizens Bank, to Merit. Those transactions are not avoidable. So to apply the exception to those intermediary steps doesn't make any sense. Court said, let's look at other sections of the code. What about charitable contributions? Section 548A2 exempts charitable contributions from avoidance. What happens if I write a check? Using the rationale of 546E, as Merit would have it applied, means that if I write a check, the payment's made by the bank, it's not made by me, and my payment is avoidable. That doesn't make any sense. Court then looked at 555, which is a section that negates the automatic stay to break swap transactions and has the same six enumerated parties as are found in 546E, and says under 555, only those six parties are subject to the statute. Why should we sweep in non-enumerated parties, the seller and the buyer, in 546E and protect them? Doesn't make any sense. The court went to the underlying reason for 546E, which was to protect the financial markets from systemic risk. And that goes back to a case called Seligson, whereby a brokerage house failed and cascaded and allowed a bankruptcy trustee to pursue a series of transactions from investors. 546E was enacted to prevent that from happening, but the court said, looking at 546E, sure, it applies if one of the parties that you're seeking to avoid the transfer from is one of those enumerated parties. If it's private parties, it doesn't apply. And therefore, we're going to find that 546E does not protect two private parties when the intermediary enumerated parties are mere conduits. The court said, we agree with a 1996 case from the 11th Circuit called Mumford, but acknowledged that five other circuits went the other way, principally on the plain meaning application of the statute. The petition was granted on May 1st, and it was argued on November 6th. Merit Management, as you might say, might expect, said, hey, the statute says what it says. It doesn't exclude looking at payments in connection with a securities contract, settlement payments, buyer to a financial institution. That's what we have here. The statute applies. Our transfer should be exempt. They said the court conflated 550 and 546E. 550 says payments made to 546E. I'm sorry, 546E says payments made to. 550 talks about initial transferee. Those concepts are different. FTI, in its brief, argues exactly the opposite. They said, Supreme Court, what we have here is one transfer. You have a transfer from Valley View to Bedford. There's not a series of transfers here. There's just one transfer. And that's the transfer that the trustee is seeking to avoid. The trustee can never avoid the intermediary steps, so it just doesn't make any sense to apply the statute to those intermediary steps. Goes on to say, 546E starts out by saying, notwithstanding 547, 545, 547, 548B, which means that those transfers have to be avoidable in the first instance for the safe harbor to apply. The Seventh Circuit was exactly right. Goes on to talk about 555 and says it makes no sense to apply 555 to just the enumerated parties, but then go over to 546E, take those same parties and protect everybody involved. The only transfer to avoid is the one from Valley View to Bedford. A number of parties filed amicus briefs. Opportunity Partners filed an amicus brief saying there was no standing, that the Merit was simply a passive investor, probably going back, although they didn't say so in their brief, to Webolt, the Seventh Circuit case, whereby the insider transfers and of LBO were held liable and the passive investors were not. The shareholders of Tribune and Lyondell, two pending cases, supported Merit and said, you know, you have to look at the complex transactions. The court should not focus on a simple private transaction as we have here. We're talking about transactions that have billions of dollars and thousands of shareholders. The court's, the Seventh Circuit's emphasis on small transactions is misplaced. The Tribune note holders and retirees, same case, other parties, said no, no, no. In support of FTI, they said the statute has to apply in the principal transaction. You can't chop it up and then allow parties who are benefiting by an LBO, the shareholders, to get all the benefit at the expense of creditors and other parties in interest. The National Association of Bankruptcy Trustees supported FTI. They went back to Jevic and said, if you allow these transactions to be insulated from attack, you're standing the priority of the code on its head. And then they went back and said, you know, I know that the shareholders of Lyondell and Tribune talked about big mega cases, but note that between 1995 and 2004, 90% of the transactions of LBOs were small cases, accounting for 80% of the value of LBOs. And that dropped to 66%, but still a majority. So small cases matter. The final brief was filed by bankruptcy law professors in support of FTI.
Probably call themselves scholars.
They probably
typically do.
Probably did. And they again hit what the Seventh Circuit said. There's only one transfer here, Judge, or Justices. There's one transfer from the Valley View to Bedford. There is no systemic risk in these transactions, so the thrust of the statute is not at issue here. They go on to say the only practical reading is to not allow a conduit transaction to be exempt. I went to a conference last month, and one of the professors signing on to this brief spoke and basically said, we don't think we're going to win. We don't think the Supreme Court is going to deviate from the plain meaning statute. However, Bill Rochelle, and we were talking about Bill Rochelle before the session, who's a former bankruptcy lawyer, a scholar, I guess, who works now for ABI,
blogger,
went to the oral arguments and said that the justices just jumped all over Merit and said, tell us why this isn't a single transaction, and gave great deference to Paul Clement, the former solicitor general, who argued for FTI and basically said, tell us how we can make a ruling that excludes conduit transactions but keeps the protections. So we'll have to see. I'm pretty sure that if the court does follow the plain meaning and says that conduit transactions are exempt, it will likely be malpractice for transaction lawyers not to use a bank as an intermediary to protect themselves from subsequent attack if the transaction fails.
Bank will collect a fee for that, I assume.
And they will collect a big fee, I'm sure. Pretty interesting case, so stay tuned.
Another case that the Supreme Court granted cert on and has heard argument on Halloween, which may explain some of the horror associated with the case. And it really is, and I want to talk about this a bit. The Supreme Court very seldom takes bankruptcy cases in order to decide sexy issues, either policy under the bankruptcy code or constitutionality. I mean, the fact that we know about Stern versus Marshall and some of those because it's so rare. Everybody knows about those. Usually, I think what the Supreme Court sees bankruptcy law as is a body of law where its obligation is to resolve splits in the circuits about the definition of the statute, what statutory provisions mean. Everybody knows that the statute is not always the most transparent, easy to understand, particularly when there are interactions either between statutory provisions and the code or between provisions in the code and the FDCPA, for example. And, you know, the Supreme Court cleans up the mess. It's one of their jobs. It's a big part of their job. Much of their decision-making through the course of any term is either unanimous or near unanimous. And those are almost all cases in which the court is engaged in statutory interpretation in things like the Bankruptcy Code, the Patent Act, other boring things. And they're just not very exciting. This would definitely, this case, U.S. Bank versus Village of Lake Ridge, and it's not a municipality, it's an LLC, which has something to do with this, is a good example of that. What's the issue presented? About as dry as dust, whether the appropriate standard of review for determining non-statutory insider status is the de novo standard of review applied by the Third, Seventh, and Tenth Circuits, or the clearly erroneous standard of review adopted by the Ninth Circuit in this case. So, what's this all come from? It comes from a confirmed Chapter 11 plan. The bank had a fully secured $10 million claim against the debtor. It proposed a plan. The debtor had proposed a plan. The only other creditor was an entity which was the sole member of the debtor and held an unsecured claim of $2.6 million. As it came down, the favorable vote of this entity for the plan, or of this piece of debt, this $2.6 million debt, for the plan is what got it confirmed. You will recall, I always think about, you will recall that the 1129 requires approval by classes of claims and interest by requisite majorities before they can be approved. And 1126E says that on request of a party in interest and after notice in a hearing, the court may designate any entity whose acceptance or rejection of such plan was not in good faith or was not solicited or procured in good faith or in accordance with the provisions of this title. What's that mean? Well, you don't count it. So this particular piece of debt's favorable vote is what got the plan confirmed. U.S. Bank didn't like the plan. So U.S. Bank objects, asks that this debt be designated. For what reason? Well, the debtor, the sole member of the debtor, this is an LLC, had five directors. You know, I tell you, they aren't sexy. Well, we got some sex in this one. One of the directors was a woman who had a close business relationship with a man named Dr. Rabkin. And after the interest holder, shareholder, whatever you want to call it, the controller of the debtor, had filed its claim, it sold the claim to Rabkin for $5,000, a $2.6 million claim. A bank moved to designate a claim and disallow it for plan voting purposes, contending that he was either a statutory insider, or he was both a statutory insider and a non-statutory insider because the claim was conveyed in bad faith. And the bankruptcy court had held a hearing, took evidence, determined that he was not a non-statutory insider because he didn't purchase in bad faith. Took evidence about how extensive the negotiations had been that led to this $5,000 price for the $2.6 million debt, determined that it was not in bad faith. But the bankruptcy court designated his claim as a statutory insider because he had acquired it from an insider, namely the interest holder in the LLC. Interesting point, by the way. This is all in, you know, the great chapter in the code, 101, the definitions. What's an insider? 101.31, as its current number is. It starts out, where will you find the LLC in here? Well, it doesn't mention it. They didn't have LLC. They had them, I guess, but they weren't very significant back in 78 or whenever it was spent. So they're probably a corporation, you know, if you look at the definition. But certainly, you look to people who are directors, officers, persons in control of the debtor, and so on. Certainly the sole member of the LLC was an insider. It was its debt that was acquired, and the question really apparently turns on whether the transfer of that debt to Dr. Rabkin was done in good faith. The Ninth Circuit BAP affirmed the bankruptcy court's decision that he was not a non-statutory insider, but reversed his finding that he was a statutory insider. And so the question that was presented by U.S. Bank to get the case before the Supreme Court really was two. Three, but two that were important. Whether the assignee of an insider acquires the insider status so that they're not allowed to vote in the Chapter 11 plan, and is de novo or clearly erroneous the appropriate standard of review, and finally, whether the proper test for non-statutory insider status requires an arm's-length analysis as applied by the other circuits, or a functional equivalent test, blah, 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 blah. See, I'm not putting you to sleep. It's all boring. But that's what the petitioner, the bank, asked the court to take up. And the court, in its wisdom, at a time when it was an eight-member court, said we're only going to grant review on one issue. That is, whether de novo or clearly erroneous is the appropriate standard of review. And it gets briefed up. They come for oral argument. And what happens? Well, it turns out, and you can read this, you know, on the SCOTUS blog or anywhere you want, there are lots of descriptions of this. It turns out it's pretty damn hard to decide what the standard of review is without knowing what the test is. The particular issue that the bank asked the court to take review on and that it didn't take review on. So they sit there talking about what the test is, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. Different justices saying, well, you know, arm's length sounds like a factual review. And, you know, whether you consider other contacts sounds like an issue of law. Indeed, it does. I mean, the prediction of people who've looked at this, my prediction is that the court is either going to ask for briefing, a supplemental briefing on this, on the issue they didn't grant review on. That is, amend their grant and grant that and have re-argument, or more likely, since it's a bankruptcy case and they didn't seem very interested in it, they're probably going to dismiss certiorari as improvidently granted. But it's very interesting. You ought to read the reports on the oral argument in the case, and you'll find out, really, my point, that they're not very interested in what goes on in the bankruptcy court. They have this idea, I think it's a good idea, that the lower courts can settle these things, but anything complicated and fact-based is better left in the hands of the lower courts, not the appellate courts. And so I think you're safe in your jobs, Judge Kelly, Judge Halfinger, whoever else is here. Nobody wants to do your work.
Everyone loves that answer. So right. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to our speakers. Stay tuned to the listserv and check the website if you're looking for a credit for December. We'll keep you posted there. Thanks again for coming.